In 2000, a Rhodes Scholar opened the Baltimore Sun and found his name attached to two wildly different stories, one celebrating his academic achievement, the other detailing a jewelry store robbery that left a police officer dead. This wasn't a mistake. There were actually two Wes Moores, one headed to Oxford, the other to prison for life. The coincidence haunted the successful Wes until he reached out to his imprisoned namesake, initiating a correspondence that would reveal chilling similarities in their early lives. Both grew up fatherless in Baltimore's struggling neighborhoods. Both faced the seductive pull of the streets. Both were Black boys navigating a world that seemed designed to swallow them whole. Yet their destinies diverged dramatically. What made the difference? The answer isn't as simple as good choices versus bad ones. It's far more nuanced, uncomfortable, and ultimately hopeful than that. This story forces us to confront a difficult truth. The line separating success from failure, freedom from incarceration, is often terrifyingly thin. The presence or absence of fathers shaped both boys profoundly. For the author, his father's death became a defining rupture. At age 3, he playfully punched his sister during a game. His mother erupted. "Never put your hands on a woman." His father intervened gently, explaining he was too young to understand. This moment revealed the contrast between his mother's fierce protectiveness and his father's patient guidance. Then came April 15, 1982. His father collapsed at the foot of their stairs, gasping for air after doctors misdiagnosed his illness. At the funeral, young Wes innocently asked his father's peaceful body, "Daddy, are you going to come with us?" The question hung in the air, unanswered. The other Wes never really knew his father. At 6, he strongly resembled Bernard, same dark skin, same haircut, same wide grin. Their only encounter happened when Mary brought him to his grandmother's house. A stranger slouched on the couch, reeking of whiskey. "Wes, meet your father," Mary said. One boy lost a loving father. The other never had one to lose. Different absences, equally formative. By age 8, the other Wes spent his days largely unsupervised while Mary worked long hours. His 14-year-old brother Tony, already a certified gangsta dealing drugs since age 10, called one morning with ironic advice: "Take school seriously." Tony had built a fierce reputation despite his skinny frame and baby face. His eyes were lifeless and hooded, showing what the neighborhood called an ice grill, a blank, hostile stare masking deeper pain. What Tony truly wanted was for Wes to avoid his mistakes, but actions speak louder than phone calls. One afternoon, playing football with neighborhood kids, Wes got into a confrontation with a smaller boy who punched him. Following his brother's code, "If someone disrespects you, send a fierce message," 8-year-old Wes grabbed a knife and went after the boy. Police intervened, handcuffing him. Meanwhile, after his father's death, the author's mother struggled to cope, finally accepting she couldn't manage alone. 3 weeks later, they packed their lime green Ford Maverick and left Maryland behind. The Bronx had transformed into what President Carter called a war zone, but his grandparents remained committed to healing what was broken. The author's mother chose Riverdale Country School, an ivy-covered campus along the Hudson once attended by JFK. For her, it represented escape. For her son, it became where he got lost. Gun Hill Road assaulted the senses with global food smells, entrepreneurial immigrants, and cacophonies of languages. This was home. Attending the white school created tension. When challenged, he fabricated stories about running things there. Crack cocaine had transformed the Bronx. The murder rate jumped 61% in the 1980s. Survival required strict rules. Never make eye contact, keep money in front pockets, know where dealers and police were. He straddled worlds: too rich for neighborhood kids, too poor for classmates. He carefully rotated his limited wardrobe and avoided bringing friends home. During a car ride, his mother discovered he could effortlessly recite complex hip-hop lyrics despite struggling in school. She realized his problem wasn't inability, but lack of effort. "You are just not working hard enough." Hip-hop validated him in both worlds, but his real problem was simpler. He was skipping school regularly, developing elaborate systems to avoid class while maintaining the appearance of attendance. After 4 days at Valley Forge Military Academy, the author had run away 4 times. One night, Sergeant Austin sent his roommate away and offered him a map to the train station. Overjoyed, he packed and slipped into the night, only to realize he'd been tricked. The map led nowhere. Lost and terrified, he broke down crying until his chain of command emerged from the darkness, laughing. Colonel Battaglioli unexpectedly allowed him a 5-minute phone call home. He begged his mother to let him return. She refused. Too many people have sacrificed for him to be there. He later learned his grandparents had taken equity from their Bronx home to pay for his first year, abandoning retirement plans to return to Jamaica. That moment, realizing the weight of other sacrifices, shifted something fundamental. Meanwhile, the other Wes turned fully to the drug trade after shooting Ray. His crew earned $4,000 daily at their peak. Though successful, Wes recognized the exploitation. He took all the risks while suppliers made real money in what he saw as raw capitalism on overdrive with bullets. Despite his street savvy, Wes made a critical error selling to an undercover officer. Surrounded by 10 officers with drawn weapons, he felt not shock but annoyance at another arrest. During a prison visit, the other Wes argued, "We become what others expect of us." This exchange crystallized how expectations, both internal and external, shape destinies. As an 18-year-old paratrooper, the author's mind races as the one-minute warning sounds. The black hats remind them, trust your equipment, trust your training, and trust your God. The green light signals go. His body is instantly sucked from the plane. After 3 terrifying seconds, his parachute opens perfectly, and he feels peace descending. While one Wes floats through air, the other confronts a different reality. Finding Cheryl unconscious from heroin, he realizes she's become the very addict he supplies drugs to. Tired of the contradictions, the violence, the drugs destroying communities, he walks to his friend Levy's house and learns about Job Corps. Despite doubts and responsibilities to his 4 children, Wes joins and excels, earning his GED while reading at a college sophomore level. He chooses carpentry, reconnecting with the satisfaction of building something with his own hands. But this positive turn proves temporary. The courtroom scene concludes with Wes's sentencing for the jewelry store robbery that killed Officer Bruce Prothero. The judge declares him a very dangerous person and sentences him to life without parole. Now he finally sees his long-term future. The hands of the state will stay on him for life. The contrast between their paths reveals a crucial truth. Success hinges on support systems. The author's journey was shaped by his mother's sacrifice, believing mentors, and stable extended family. The other Wes Moore, despite similar promise, lacked these structures at pivotal moments. This story challenges the pull-yourself-up-by-your-bootstraps myth. The author became a Rhodes Scholar, Afghanistan paratrooper, and White House Fellow. The other Wes Moore earns 53 cents daily as a prison carpenter at Jessup Correctional Institution. Individual moments, a teacher's attention, a neighbor's guidance, a dealer's influence, tip the scales. Samuel Beckett's words echo, try again, fail better. Failure isn't the enemy, stagnation is. True success lies in creating opportunities for others, transforming individual triumph into collective progress. The question, what will we do with this knowledge?